Chapter 34. Canyon, hotel and stations named for Spanish priests. At Williams, the gateway to the canyon, the Santa Fe Railway Company recently has erected a typical mission-style hotel, to which the name of Fray Marcus has been given. Here canyon visitors who stop off between trains find excellent accommodations. At Needles, California, on the Colorado River, is another reinforced concrete building, named after another Franciscan priest, Francisco Garces. Both Fray Marcus and El Garces are managed by Fred Harvey, who also has charge of El Tovar Hotel. The history of this part of the Southwest for the last 30 years cannot be written without mention of this masterful man, who made railway meal service a fine art. In accordance with a policy established some time ago by the Santa Fe Company, the architecture of their station hotels conforms to the Spanish mission styles, as far as possible, and they are given names of those who are inseparably connected with the romantic history of this region. Fray Marcus comes to America. In the chapter Over and the Discovery of the Grand Canyon, brief reference is made to the reconnaissance undertaken by Fray Marcus de Niza, a Franciscan friar, to determine the truth of the reports brought in to Culiacan by Cabeza de Vaca. This narrative of Fray Marcus is taken, in the main, from George Parker Winship's introduction to his translation of Castaneda's narrative, published in the 14th Annual Report of the United States Bureau of Ethnology. This friar was born in Nice, then a part of Savoy, and he came to America about the year 1531. His contemporaries called him a Frenchman, though there is no evidence that he was of French parentage. He was sent as one of the religious to accompany Pizarro on his expedition to Peru, and was present at the trial and execution of the native king, Atahualpa. From Peru, he returned to Central America, and thence he returned on foot to Mexico. He was a man of known bravery and character, and already was appointed to the office of vice-commissary of his order. Thus Mendoza felt no hesitation at charging him with the arduous mission of penetrating to the heart of what are now Arizona and New Mexico, as far as the reported seven cities of Cibola, and bringing back to his superiors a truthful account of what he saw. The father provincial of the order, Fray Antonio de Ciudad Rodrigo, on August 26, 1539 certified to the high esteem in which Fray Marcus was held, and stated that he was skilled in cosmography, and in the arts of the sea, as well as in theology. Mendoza instructs Fray Marcus. Mendoza drew up for him a set of instructions as to how he should proceed. These were very explicit as to the good treatment the Indians were to receive at his hands, and required him to make certain scientific observations with due care and thoroughness. He was to leave letters at stated intervals, and also send back to the viceroy reports of his progress, wherever possible. Coronado escorted him as far as the new town of Culiacan, and on March 7, 1539, accompanied by a lay brother, Honorado, he started on his trip. Courage of Spaniards. When it is remembered that this journey of several hundreds of miles was on foot, for the rule of the Franciscans was that all their members should travel afoot save in cases of extreme necessity, through a barren, almost waterless desert, roamed over by warlike Indians, the courage of the man is apparent. Yet he was not remarkable in this. The history of Mexico, and of all the Spanish colonies, as well as those of New Mexico which used to include Arizona, Texas, and California, abounds in the names of men of equal courage and daring. On reaching Patatlan, Brother Honorado fell sick, and Marcus had to leave him behind. Thence alone, as far as white men were concerned, he traveled to Cibola. Six Indian interpreters and a large number of natives accompanied and followed him, and Stephen, the Negro, went ahead as his guide. Investigates regarding Pearl Islands. He reached Vacapa, now known as Matapa, in central Sonora, 2 days before Passion Sunday, which in 1539 fell on March 23rd. From this point he sent to the seacoast for some Indians, in order that he might learn from them something about the Pearl Islands, of which rumors had come to Cabeza de Vara. He remained here until April 6. Stephen, the guide, is sent ahead. In the meantime, Stephen had pushed on to the north, leaving on Passion Sunday, with orders from Fray Marcus, not to go further than 50 or 60 leagues ahead. If he found any signs of a rich and populous country, before he had gone that distance, he was not to proceed further, but was to return for Marcus, or remain, and send messengers for him, bearing a white cross the size of the palm of his hand. If the news was very promising, the cross was to be twice the size, and if the country about which he heard promised to be larger and better than New Spain, as Mexico was then generally known, a cross still larger than this was to be sent back. Castaneda says that Stephen was sent on ahead, because he and Marcus did not agree well, the Negro not only showing covetousness and the determination to acquire the turquoises of the natives, but also an amorousness that demanded of them their youngest and prettiest women. Messengers bring good news to Marcus. 4 days after his departure, messengers sent by Stephen reached Fray Marcus with a very large cross as tall as a man. This, according to the signs established between them, meant wonderful news. One of the messengers told what it was. He it was, indeed, who had given the news to the Negro, and he, in turn, had sent the native on to Fray Marcus. This is what Marcus records of the Indian story. Report of Turquoise Stones. There are 7 very large cities in the first province, all under one lord, with large houses of stone and lime, the smallest 1 story high, with a flat roof above, and others 2 and 3 stories high, and the house of the lord 4 stories high. They are all united under his rule. And on portals of the principal houses there are many designs of turquoise stones, of which he says they have a great abundance, and the people in these cities are very well clothed. Concerning other provinces farther on, he said that each one of them amounted to much more than these 7 cities. Marcus got a very clear idea of what actually existed, though he misunderstood the democratic community rule of the people of Cibola, under a chief whom they had elected to the office, for the rule of an overlord. The houses were built about as he describes, and whitewashed inside, and out with gypsum, and though the placing of turquoises in the door jams is discontinued, the traditions of the people clearly indicate that at one time that was their general practice. Messenger from the coast returns. Had he been a man of great impatience, Marcus would have started off at once to discover the truth or falsity of these reports, but he waited until his messenger who had been sent to the coast returned, with natives of that region. These told him of pearls found in quantity near their homes. Other Indians, with painted or tattooed faces, chests and arms, living to the east, doubtless the Pimas or Sabapiras, also visited him, and told him of the 7 villages with which they claimed to be familiar. Marcus follows Stephen. The friar was now ready to start, and on the 2nd day following Easter, April 6, he left, expecting to find Stephen waiting for him at the village from which his messenger had been sent. Instead, he met a 2nd cross, much larger than the first one, with messengers who gave a fuller and completer account of the 7 villages, but agreeing in every particular with what had been told before. All this was confirmed when Friar Marcus reached the first village, so he hastened on, doubtless annoyed somewhat that Stephen had disobeyed his orders, and journeyed beyond the prescribed distance. But it was perhaps well for him that Stephen had done so. Gathering turquoises and women as he proceeded, and followed by an increasing number of natives, the Negro pushed on to Cibola. Before arriving at the principal town, he sent forward a notice of his approach in the shape of a gourd, to which were attached a few strings of rattles and 2 plumes, one white and the other red. This was unfortunate for Stephen, for undoubtedly it was part of the paraphernalia of a medicine man of a tribe hostile to the Cibolans. Its receipt made the people both angry and suspicious. The chief who received the gourd threw it upon the ground, and told the messengers that when their people reached the village, they would find out what sort of men lived there, and that instead of entering the place, they would all be killed. Stephen paid no attention to this warning, but recklessly entered the village. He was duly received by the chief, but instead of his being acclaimed, and a generous welcome accorded him, he was coldly requested to remain without the walls, and occupy a house that was pointed out to him. This for years has been the habit of the Zuni people of our time, in dealing with strange Mexicans who come to visit them, owing to their religious ceremonies. Stephen is killed. Poor Stephen's confidence doubtless began to leave him the following day, when his turquoises and women were taken from him, and he found himself a prisoner without food or drink. As much afraid now as he had been overconfident before, he endeavored, during the early morning hours, to escape, but was overtaken and killed, together with some of his followers. The others, to the number of 60, returned to Fray Marcos with the appalling news. Indian followers wished to desert. But, undaunted and unafraid, the brave friar kept on his way. He was sent to see the villages of Cibola, and make a report on them. He had injured no one, and intended to injure no one. While he must be circumspect, and not risk his life unnecessarily, he must perform his duty, even though by so doing he put his life in jeopardy. Another difficulty confronted him. The first reports of Stephen's death were accompanied with the statement that all of his native followers were also slain. As soon as the Indians who were with Fray Marcos heard this, they wished to desert and return home at once. But he opened up some bundles of presents he had with him, and by a free distribution of them prevailed upon his escort to remain. Then he went apart to pray, and while he was gone the ingrate Indians decided to kill him as the source of all their troubles. It took a good deal of argument, more presents, and some threats, to persuade them that to kill him would be the height of folly. Before they had time to hatch up any more plots, he succeeded in getting two of the chief men to go with him to a hilly place overlooking the city of Cibola, which he describes as a city on a plain, on the slope of a round height. In his report he writes, Marcus's description of Cibola. It has a very fine appearance for a village, the best that I have seen in these parts. The houses, as the Indians had told me, are all of stone, built in stories, and with flat roofs. Judging by what I could see from the height, where I placed myself to observe it, the settlement is larger than the city of Mexico. It appears to me that this land is the best and largest of all those that have been discovered. Marcus returns with his report. With far more fright than food, says the candid friar, he hastened back to New Spain, and made his report to Coronado in person at Compostela. Later he wrote it officially to the viceroy, also to the head of his order, and on September 2nd in the presence of both Mendoza and Coronado, swore to the truth of what he had written. High office is given him. I have already in another chapter told of the effect of Fray Marcos's report. It made a most popular man of him, and soon thereafter, when the position of Father Provincial of his order was vacant, he was chosen to fill the office, the highest in the district. Henceforth he was called to fill all the pulpits of the region. He became known as a great preacher, and doubtless interlarded his sermons with many references to his wonderful adventures in search of the famous Even Cities. The result was the whole country became excited, and many went on the expedition, the failure of which we are familiar with. Cortes discredits Marcus. In the meantime, Cortes was not quiet. It must not be forgotten that he claimed all this northern country by right of discovery, and he protested most vigorously against the sending forth of Coronado's expedition. Just as Coronado was about to start, Cortes returned to Spain, and there presented a memorial to the king, June 25, 1540, setting forth in detail the ill treatment which he had received from Mendoza. In this, according to Winship, He declared that after the Viceroy had ordered him to withdraw his men from their station on the coast of the mainland toward the north, where they were engaged in making ready for extended inland explorations, he had a talk with Fray Marcus. And I gave him, says Cortez, an account of this said country, and of its discovery, because I had determined to send him in my ships, to follow up the said northern coast and conquer that country, because he seemed to understand something about matters of navigation. The said friar communicated this to the said viceroy, and he says that, with his permission, he went by land in search of the same coast and country as that which I had discovered, and which it was and is my right to conquer. And since his return, the said friar has published the statement that he came within sight of the said country, which I deny that he has either seen or discovered. But instead, in all that the said friar reports that he has seen, he only repeats the account I had given him regarding the information which I obtained from the Indians of the said country of Santa Cruz, because anything which the said friar says that he discovers is just the same as what these said Indians had told me. And in enlarging upon this, and in pretending to report what he neither saw nor learned, the said Friar Marcus does nothing new, because he has done this many other times, and this was his regular habit, as is notorious in the provinces of Peru and Guatemala. And sufficient evidence regarding this will be given to the court whenever it is necessary. Marcus an exaggerator. Cortez never made any attempt to confirm his statements, and it is well known that he himself was very reckless in his handling of the truth, where his own purposes were to be served, or the plans of his enemies defeated. It seems a pretty clear matter that, while the friar told the truth as nearly as possible as to what he actually saw, he did not hesitate to let the more exaggerated statements of the things he had merely heard have as full weight as the people to whom he told them desired. Anyhow, he has suffered a great deal of abuse as an exaggerator, and even worse, though it must never be forgotten, that people who fail are always ready to blame everyone concerned except themselves. Bandlier warmly defends Fray Marcus, and his knowledge is confessedly great, but Winship thinks he treats the charge too lightly. Poor Fray Marcus, afflicted with rheumatism, had a painful time during the remainder of his life, and finally died March 25, 1558 in the house of his order, in the city of Mexico. Religious zeal of Garces. It is appropriate also that Fray Francisco Garces should find an honored place in these necessarily brief historical notices. Fired with a wonderful zeal for souls, without the urging or backing of any superior, save the Spirit of God, which spoke to his own soul, he marched from San Xavier del Bac, his station in northern Mexico, now Arizona, across these inhospitable wilds, merely seeking opportunities for the establishment of mission settlements, where the natives could learn of the way of Christ, salvation from sin, and heaven. Five times he left his mission, and made entradas, as they are called, into the interior country, anxious to expand his work and his influence. On the third of these, he followed the course of the Gila down to the Colorado River, and descended along its banks, possibly as far as its mouth. His fourth journey was with the intrepid Captain Juan Bautista de Anza, when he set forth in 1774. To discover a road from the missions already established in northern Mexico, over the then unknown Arizona and Colorado deserts, to the new missions of California. The road was discovered, and, in spite of its hardships, deemed feasible, for in 1775-1776 De Anza went over it again, accompanied by the band he had gathered together for the establishment of a Spanish colony at San Francisco. His chaplain on this occasion was Padre Pedro Font. Fray Garces, a fellow Franciscan, also went along as far as the Colorado River. Here he left the party, journeyed down the Colorado to the Gulf, returned to the Mojaves, then crossed the Colorado Desert to San Gabriel Mission in California, back again to the Mojaves, and finally across the Arizona Desert to the province of Tucson, the land of the Hoppus. Havasu Pace guide Garces to the Hopi towns. It was on June 4, 1776, memorable year in American annals, that Garces started under the guidance of some Wallapais for the Hopi towns. They had given him fair details of the country he would have to travel over. Passing by their own home in Diamond Creek, one of the earliest approaches to the Grand Canyon, he decided to visit the Havasupais, whom he calls Yabesuas. Those familiar with Spanish spelling and pronunciation will readily recognize that they are almost one and the same. The Wallapais took the priest down their own trail into Havasu or Cataract Canyon, a trail which made his head swim, and where his mule had to be left behind, to be brought to him later by another route. He also describes the ladder down which he climbed, just before reaching the place where the innumerable springs flow out of the solid rock and form Havasu Creek. It was the same ladder descended 80 years later by Eglefstein, Lieutenant Ives' artist, who was so heavy that he took down ladder and all with him. Here Garces stayed 5 days, being hospitably treated by the natives, who brought him melons, squash, corn, beans, etc., and who had thriving trees of peaches and apricots. The Grand Canyon is reached. Leaving the kind-hearted Havasupais, he returned to the plateau above, and soon saw for the first time the deep gorge of the Colorado River itself, the Grand Canyon. He describes with surprising accuracy of detail the break in the Kaibabs, where the Marble and Little Colorado Canyons unite and form the Grand Canyon, and then, a little later, he gives a true description of the Little Colorado Canyon. From his account, he doubtless went down by the old Hopi Salt Trail into the gorge of the Little Colorado, and thus on to Araby, which he reached July 2, 1776. Wishes to baptize the Indians. About this time those interesting, exciting and most important of all discussions were raging in the Continental Congress on the eastern side of the continent, which, 2 days later, were to result in the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson had undoubtedly written it at this time, but Garces knew not the name of the great patriot and his compeers. He was bent on a different mission. He wished to declare to the Hopis how they might have freedom, freedom from sin and the fear of hell. For, as Elliot Cowes, the scholarly translator, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.